You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On this week's Mysteries and Monsters, I am delighted to welcome the legendary Doug Hychek to the show. Doug has been instrumental in bringing a more science-based approach to cryptozoology through his work on Legend Meets Science, The Wonderful Monster Quest, and is now currently working on his latest project, Legend Meets Science 2, with a whole batch of Bigfoot researchers, investigators, and scientists. Doug and I talk about his career working on wildlife documentaries, his strange discovery in the Northern Territories whilst trying to catch footage of another alleged cryptid, and Bigfoot in general. Doug gives us an overview of all the work going into his new film, amongst many other things, as well as his work with Les Stroud on Survivor Man Bigfoot. It was an absolute pleasure to spend some time in Doug's company. But before we get there, as always, you can sign up for ad-free episodes via Patreon. Search on Patreon for Mysteries and Monsters, as we've now been removed from an adult content rating for some reason, or you can click on the link in the show notes. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also now get all your merchandise, t-shirts, mugs and more, by clicking on the links on the mysteriesandmonsters.com website. Artwork, as always, is by Dean Bestel. The show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. With over 30 years of experience hunting those elusive cryptids, let's join Doug Hychek to open our minds. On today's Mystery and Monsters, I am joined by Doug Hychek, a successful television documentary series producer and television show creator, committed to bringing daring voices and innovative ideas to the screen. As a massive fan of Doug's previous work over the last 20 years, I am delighted to welcome him to the show. Doug, thank you for joining me, sir.
Yeah, my pleasure, Paul.
Well, it's a bit daunting for me, I have to say, Doug. As I touched on earlier, I have been a big fan of your work. I have to personally say that Monster Quest is probably my favourite cryptozoological show ever.
Cool.
And it's one of those shows that it's just been getting rerun here in the UK. They've just reshown season 3, which is one of those wonderful things that we're able to get hold of them all now over here in the UK again, because they kind of disappeared for a long time from our screens. And it's always been very interesting to me that whole show, Doug, because I think the one thing I really enjoyed about Monster Quest was the fact that it had a very wide scope in regards to the cases and the witnesses and the incidents it covered. Was that deliberate when it first started?
Yeah, I would probably say it was. First off, you know, I started doing Monster Quest, as I did all of my crypto shows, basically as a researcher first,
mm-hmm.
because the TV show gave me a reason and it gave me the funding and the excuse, you know, to take the huge amount of time to get into the field, to test things. And I think that's what people sense about the show as being different. It wasn't done by some intern in New York who had no interest in the topic, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But the variety, you know, kind of really was, most of it was just carried on my curiosity, you know, whatever I was curious about. You know, if some case came up or I'd heard about something or I knew about something and I was really curious about it, normally I wouldn't be able to go investigate it. But through Monster Quest, you know, we were able to, you know, go investigate it, apply science, and, you know, basically bring those things in science and the witnesses, you know, to the world.
Do you think it's because obviously I think one of the things that some people may not be aware of, Doug, outside of your work in Monster Quest and other fabulous cryptid-based pieces of work that you've released, is that you had a real sort of grounding working in wildlife documentaries, yeah. and exploration before that for probably about 20 years, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I started out It's just basically a kid with a dream that wanted to get into the TV business, grew up just obsessed with wildlife and animals. And I was curious on many things that I couldn't get answers from my parents or the encyclopedias. You know, I'd ask, well, what is a bear doing? Instead, I'd ask my dad, you know, what does it do all winter? You know, does it just lay there? Does it sleep? Does it, you know, and nobody could ever answer any of my questions when I was a kid. They called them Dougie questions because literally my parents were crazy with questions that they could not answer.
Yeah.
And so as I got older, video cameras, of course, the first video camera that became available for the consumer I ended up buying was $1,400 in the 70s.
Yeah.
In the 1970s, people had never even heard the word video. Mm. You know, when I bought a video camera, that word, it wasn't even in the dictionary. And so I already had a video camera and was already out taping wildlife. And it was just amazing. I would just spend time in the woods, in swamps and forests, and doing that. And then eventually I ended up pitching an outdoor writer who I just met. And I pitched him. I said, hey, I'd love to do a TV show. And I had never done TV, ever, Paul. I had no idea even how to do it, you know, how to make a TV show.
Yeah.
But I thought, oh, I can always hire people that knew those. So, so I pitched him this show.
Yeah.
And, of course, over a glass of whiskey on a napkin, he goes, yeah, let's do it. And so all of a sudden, like the next day, he had a meeting set up at a TV CBS affiliate. And so we met, and the next thing you know, the president of this affiliate said, let's do it. So here I am. No training, no anything, except an interest in the outdoors, and this was going to be an outdoor show, to produce this TV show. And you can imagine the panic that set in. So what I ended up doing was probably working harder than any other producer to try to make sure everything was right, that I had everything figured out. And it was funny because my first shoot was with a news anchor who we were doing a story. He was an avid fisherman, and we were doing a story on catching night crawlers.
Yeah.
How to catch night crawlers. And when, anyhow, we got done shooting, and he had called the sports writer, the host of the TV show. By the way, it's still on the air, just so you know.
Yeah.
Called him and said that he, Doug was the best producer I'd ever worked with. And I was thinking, what the heck? And it was just because I was so scared.
Yeah.
And so I worked really hard. So I ended up probably working harder than anybody because I never had formal training in biology. I never had formal training in television production, shooting, this, that. But, you know, I just got good just doing it.
Yeah.
And as time went on, through that show, I started meeting a lot of biologists. And, of course, I took advantage of that going, hey, can I come up and visit with you, you know, and follow you around and see what you're doing? And so I started hanging out with all these different biologists, and that led me to doing a lot of camera placements, you know, in weird areas, and it helped my career grow, like putting in cameras in bear dens and beaver lodges and underwater. And, you know, just it went on and on and on. I was just interested in seeing into another dimension and to get answers to all the questions I had asked when I was a kid and couldn't get answers for.
To be fair, I was really interested because I've heard about this filming that you've done in regards to the beaver lodges, Doug. And it's very interesting because obviously here in the UK, we're just currently reintroducing beavers back into the UK. I think they were driven to extinction about 400 years ago, Doug. So we've started a government program here in the UK, in Scotland, and now they're releasing them in England as well to reintroduce them into natural environment.
Fantastic.
I was really interested to hear about this footage that you've caught where there's this. I mean, I thought it was mind-blowing, to be honest. This symbiotic relationship you've discovered between beavers and muskrats. And I was thinking, you know, obviously what's going on here in the UK at the moment, clearly we don't have muskrats.
Well, it's actually more than a symbiotic relationship. It was the world's first mammals of different species cohabitation. So they're actually living, build, and live together in a home.
Yeah.
You know, in the beaver lodge. And so they'll certainly be, without introducing the muskrat, which I believe are involved in most beaver lodges.
Yeah.
Because the muskrats have their job. They clean up all the mess on the floor. They do all the bedding. They bring in all the bedding for the beavers. The beavers just work on the walls and the roof as the water levels rise and fall with the rainfall and, you know, the seasonal changes. And the muskrats play a very important role in beaver survival. And so, yeah, we observed for the first time this interaction, documented almost a full year of it.
Mm.
And the muskrats, I mean, right down to grooming the beavers and keeping the beavers healthy and free of parasites.
Yeah.
So it was shocking to all of us. And at one point, I think we documented mink, weasels, mice, muskrats, and beavers all utilizing the lodge.
Wow. I mean, it is remarkable because I think it's one of those things that often, when we think about the natural world and how popular animal documentaries are across the world, Doug, especially here in the UK and America, you know, there are whole channels devoted to nature documentaries 24 hours a day. I'm still flabbergasted when we stumble across these things that have basically been staring us in the face all this time.
Yeah, I mean, think about how I felt as really just an uneducated, curious person.
Mm.
To be the one to solve so many of these mysteries and get footage. And it just kind of shocks me. And what it does let me know is that we need more curiosity in our lives with our citizens. A citizen scientist, just somebody who's curious, can do a lot of really cool wildlife research if they just put their mind to it.
Yeah.
You know, if they're curious and then just, you know, seek out help from biologists. If you need to be surprised, I'll bet you there are an endless amount of things we do not know about the forest, the ecology, the relationships between different animals. I think there's just, you know, immense secrets that are still being kept from us. And it was interesting to note that the Indians and the natives here had talked about the relationship between the beaver and the muskrats. And yet no human being, think about this, no human being in history had peered inside a beaver lodge when no one was around.
Yeah.
And to put this camera in, that took 2 years to get this camera chiseled in this, finally figured out this tube system.
Yeah.
Because if you just put a hole in a beaver lodge, they'll quickly patch it up.
Yes.
So, you know, I had to come up with a system that the beavers would ignore. So it would look like another log in the roof.
Yeah.
So it was airtight. So there was zero air leakage. Well, that's not easy to do.
No.
So I just used a PVC tube and then used sponge and insulation around it and then had another tube on the inside of that one that was very tight. That would then, the camera was in so I could, you know, raise and lower the camera or fix it or clean it without disturbing the lodge. I could pull the inner tube out and then clean the lens, put it back quickly and seal it up so no air leaked in, and it worked. But if you're introducing beavers back into the UK, it's going to be a tremendous change to the ecology of Britain and Scotland and wherever they spread to.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. It really is.
Yeah. No, there seems to be a real appetite for this rewilding, they're calling it here, Doug, where we're sort of looking to reintroduce another.
Oh, that's amazing.
They're on about reintroducing the lynx and also some wolf colonies up in Scotland. So it's very interesting how we've turned it round from sort of 40 years ago, sort of pushing everything to the brink here in the UK. And obviously, it's one of those things that I think the more natural resources you reintroduce, I think it gives a more sustainable impact on the natural environment for everybody.
Yeah, it's amazing. They introduced wolves back into Yellowstone, and it stopped stream erosion.
Yeah.
Now, what would wolves have to do with stream erosion? Well, it was because the ungulates were overpopulated.
Yeah.
and they were eating all of the browse, meaning the new trees that were budding up along the stream banks, and, you know, trampling the stream banks. And of course, that affects water quality. And all of a sudden, they introduce wolves. Next thing you know, the ungulate population comes under control.
Yeah.
And the streams start getting cleaner.
Yeah.
And they start growing trees on the bank, and the erosion stops.
Yeah.
And you would think, God, that connection is so bizarre, you know. Yeah. You talked about, you had mentioned beavers. Mm. I want to say one last thing about beavers, that they're one of the only animals like man that changes its environment,
mm-hmm.
like we do, builds a home like we do, heats its home with heat from the ground like we do.
Yes.
And now find out they have pets. Basically, like
yeah.
we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, just fascinating.
It is. I mean, that Yellowstone reintroduction is phenomenal as well, because I think it just showed you, because that population ungulates were just basically, they've got no predators, Doug, so they were just hanging around all the time, and it's remarkable to see the change in the natural environment, because obviously all the flowers have started coming back, because these guys aren't just sitting there grazing anymore. They're on the move all the time, aren't they?
Yes, correct. Yeah, they're not, you know, the ungulates and the deer and the, you know, and the elk and the moose, and they're not just hanging out one spot and overgrazing. They have to move to hide.
Mm.
They have to move out of territories. It just changed everything.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, of course, bison, there's a new theory that, like, some of the big ungulates actually stop global warming
mm.
and climate change, because by them walking, you know, like the bison up in the Arctic, and the musk ox and so on, that they keep the permafrost frozen.
Yeah.
And, you know, you read these things that they're just now starting to understand, and it's just... You know, where they feel, oh, we reintroduce bison again or muskox into these areas, you know, we'll be able to slow down climate change.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It is. And it just shows you the ramifications of just one change in the natural yep. world, how massive a difference it can make when you know, I'm sure when they introduced the wolf population back into Yellowstone, Doug, they weren't thinking about the return of the flora. Or the no. streams, they were just thinking about getting the deer numbers under control.
Yes, yeah, I think they were shocked. But that's what we learn, and then we learn a little bit more. And wouldn't it be, I think it'd be wonderful to have wolves back in the UK.
Mm.
You know, the farmers don't necessarily love it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we can all learn to live with predators.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think... Often it's one of those things that a lot of creatures such as that don't get demonized, I think, and that's one of those things we have to look back on history over for, yeah. I think, more than anything. And it's very interesting to me, looking at your body of work as well, that you also seem to have a real passion for bears, Doug.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Just fascinated with bears. It's been a life-changing, I guess, awakening. One, to learn of their intelligence, the fact that we can live with them,
mm-hmm.
the fact that they're very, you know, they're really, in most cases, very timid, unless they're starving. You know, they don't normally do anything to our bird feeders and our homes and cars unless they're starving. And even then, we can learn to live with them. I mean, they're living with, God, 40,000 black bears in New Jersey right now. They're in the suburbs. They're everywhere. And they're living with them just fine. I had bear, big, huge bear tracks on my beach in my backyard
mm.
here recently. And, you know, there's probably hasn't been a bear in my area for years. And now they're being sighted on a regular basis where I live, you know, right around my neighborhood. It's very cool.
Oh, fabulous. Are they just generally sort of moving back into the area because there's been a restriction on hunting? Or is it just natural sort of... lack of natural resources is forcing them to move around, though?
No, I think it's the acceptance.
Mm.
I worked very hard in changing attitudes of people through TV, through shows on Animal Planet that I produced, and things of that nature. I did like The Man That Walks With Bears.
Yeah.
And that was really about a biologist who was doing bear research based on trust, Dr. Lynn Rogers.
Mm.
And when the opportunity came up to radio collar a bear without drugs and videotape it, you know, a wild bear without drugs, yes. Because this biologist had lost his permit. He was kind of, he was outperforming the government in his research. And I think they got a little jealous and they took away his permit to radio collar bears,
yeah.
You know, or to tranquilize them.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, you know, why don't you just try to put a collar on a bear and you have to bolt them on? And I said, get your video camera out, get a tripod, get a treat, some sweetened condensed milk to distract them and film it and just bolt a radio collar on it. Sure enough, the bear let it, you know, it was distracted enough. And bears pretty much constantly judge your demeanor.
Mm.
They're extremely intelligent. They're like one of the few animals that can kind of be tamed as an adult because they're so smart.
Yeah.
They're like chipmunks. I don't know if you have chipmunks or ground squirrels in Britain that, you know, with the stripes, they're very tame.
Mm.
If you, you know, hold out food and you're patient with them, you can tame them as an adult. Well, bears are kind of like that too. Anyhow, so we ended up doing a show based on bear research on trust, and that show changed my life as it did a lot of other people's attitudes about, you know, bears and that we can live with them. So now when they come into neighborhoods, people don't shoot them anymore.
Yeah.
The DNR doesn't come out and shoot them. They leave them alone.
Yeah.
And that's why they're back. It's just because we're not shooting them.
Mm. Oh, well, that's fantastic. And long may that kind of education continue, though.
And, you know, I work with the North American Bear Center here in Ely, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody wants to go to their site, it's the North American Bear Center .org. And it is really about educating people that we can live with black bears.
It's very interesting for me when you look at this, the quality of the work that you've done in the natural world, that it, for many, I suppose, Doug, it would be surprising that you've got this real passion in regards to cryptozoology.
Yes.
And obviously this is... Obviously, I've heard you say that you've always had an interest in this subject before you stumbled across these footprints in the Arctic Circle when you'd gone to do some filming. Now,
right.
Was that in regards to the filming? Because I think were you also around that time, did you do a documentary about the Point Lake Monster in the Northwestern
yeah.
Territories? Is
yes.
that why
yep.
you were up there?
Yeah, how did you hear about that?
Ah, you see? I do listen, Doug.
I did a show up on Point Lake, and Jim Peterson was the guy's name.
Mm.
And he told me in confidence about a fish that he and this man had gone fishing, and they were near, I think it was called the Windy River.
Mm.
And they were pulled around by a fish all day long, you know, in a boat. And they ended up finally, after 6 hours, seeing the last, as he said, the last 6 foot of a trout.
Mm.
So that meant that trout was probably 8 foot long.
Mm.
And so I ended up producing a show for PBS
mm.
Called, I think it was just called The Point Lake Monster, which was probably my first crypto show.
Yeah.
But it was up there in the Arctic where I personally also saw a giant trout. And I realized they had gotten out of its niche. It just wasn't a normal trout. You know, it probably stayed deep, became a cannibal because that's what it was trying to do when I saw it. It was trying to eat a 30-pound trout that I was reeling in.
Yes.
And I thought it was like a man swimming in the water underwater. It was that big. So I went back up to the Arctic to try to get footage of one of these creatures, and I built a bunch of camera systems and lures. And you know, I went up there with a biologist, and it was on that trip that we came upon these Bigfoot footprints. They came out of the water, which was, you know, shallow water.
Hmm.
So whether it swam or whatever it did, came up through the wet sand because it was raining that day, left crystal clear footprints,
yeah.
Went into the pea gravel as the sand transitioned into pea gravel.
Hmm.
There were footprints there. They were in a straight line. We followed him into the moss, and they were deep, deep, deep into the moss. Followed him right up to the where there was a little tree line of stunted black spruce trees. And there was a footprint in front of the trunk. And if you know, a lot of people don't know this, but Bigfoot, they leave footprints that are in a perfectly straight line as if they're walking on a tight rope. You know, 1 foot exactly in front of the other.
Yeah.
And here was a footprint behind the tree trunk and one directly in line on the other side of the trunk. That was a life-changing moment for me. Because I realized it stepped over the tree.
Yeah.
And you can imagine the confusion that we all had. But then it just hit me, you know, because obviously this couldn't have been anything other than a Sasquatch. And it just stepped over this 7 foot tree like it was a weed.
Yeah. The thing about that area as well, Doug, is it's one of those places where you say, oh, well, I had this experience in the Arctic Circle. And people just, I think some people are mystified when they realize you're talking about Canada, because the Northwestern Territories is a very barren area. It's essentially, I mean, this is one of those things as well, Doug, that for you to be in that specific place, which is, to say it's sparsely populated, I think would be an overestimate. You know, there is nothing for hundreds of miles around there. So
nothing. I would say thousands of miles. You know, it's just there's no roads. Everywhere you go, you have to go by a float plane. It's just probably the chance of me running into those footprints were, you know, very high odds. Millions and millions to one.
Yeah.
But what a life-changing moment. So it not only changed my life, I mean, it changed all the people I've worked with over the years. It certainly has changed the face of cryptozoology because I was so passionate about getting the word out and getting the science out. And once again, my curiosity was fueled. You know, I love a good mystery. And I always feel, you know, that you can get answers to mysteries if you really put your mind to it.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Legend Meets Science was then born out of that after actually years of struggle to try to get a network to believe in me to get the show done. And I think doing the bear documentary I did, the first one, had so many science breakthroughs in it.
Yeah.
Filming back black bears in their lodge, filming the first cubs under a mother, using the first infrared camera in history on a network.
Yeah.
They were so intrigued by infrared technology at that point, they flew two executives out to see the technology that I was going to use because I wanted to use it, and I had to run it by the producers at Discovery Channel. And they didn't even know what I was talking about, you know. And I needed permission to run it into a broadcast show.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't very high res. It was probably, 480 by 640 resolution. And TV, of course, was a little higher than that. So they came out and gave me the blessing. I, of course, had IR, following bears around at night. Can be very unnerving, but the bears generally, if you, even in pitch darkness, if you just follow them around, eventually they just ignore you.
Yeah.
And you can lay down with them. You can sleep with them next to them. And the footage that we got, of course, was really amazing.
Yeah. When you sort of had this experience, Doug, and it, as you say, it changed your life. Obviously as you refer to there, it seems as if it was a real challenge for people to take it seriously. And I think looking back, because obviously Bigfoot is something I've been interested in all my life since I saw the Patterson-Gimlin footage when I was a child, which was shown over here. So for me, it's very interesting that when I look back at that era of the 90s, obviously your incident, I think, was 91, was it?
Yes. Yep.
It's very interesting that at that point, everything seemed to be about aliens and UFOs and intergalactic travel. And that seemed to be the main thing that everybody was talking about on television and most of the shows. And nobody seemed to be really... It's almost as if Bigfoot or Sasquatch had kind of been pushed to one side. It wasn't fashionable anymore.
Right. Yeah, it was totally. totally unfashionable. In fact, you know, after we got the show done, Paul, Legend Meets Science, we got the whole thing done. We had groundbreaking information in this, right down to the, you know, the latent details, the fingerprinting, all sorts of analytical data, on and on and on. I had discovered the hernia on the thigh, which we went into detail on that. You know, remember when I think it was Bob Hieronymus came forward and had claimed that, you know, everything had, you know, been attributed to him. And there was another guy, I can't think of his name right now, that came forward that said he had made all the footprints in the whole, you know, freaking world, basically.
Yeah. Was it Ray Wallace?
Yeah, Ray Wallace, yeah. And I remember getting a call from Discovery from my executive producer at Discovery, and he goes, "It's too bad we can't run your show now." And I blew up at him, and I gave him a lecture. It's like every so many years some idiot comes forward and makes a bunch of claims, unsubstantiated, and it's just another story that's completely unsubstantiated. We just ignore it.
Yeah.
And I talked him into then rerun, you know, to run the show.
Yeah.
But, boy, that was a close call.
Yeah, yeah. And it is remarkable as well. I mean, even if you look at your personal experience, Doug, what are the chances that anybody would fly into the middle of the Northwestern Territories to create a set of footprints on the off chance someone may find them? And when somebody comes forward like Wallace did, I find it more incredible that people accept that explanation than the possibility that there is an unknown creature out there. Because it's almost as if this kind of explanation, oh, well, that's it. When you get one of these one-size-fits-all explanations, I'm stunned sometimes when people go, oh, well, that's it. It's all done and dusted. And you just think, well, what? So he was going to California, to Florida, to Alabama, to Tennessee, to Utah, to British Columbia, up into the Yukon. He was going to Alaska. I mean, come on.
I mean, I remember the headlines, Paul. It was like, Bigfoot, case closed. Like, what?
Yeah.
I remember John Green, how mad he was.
Yeah.
I've never seen John so fired up. And he continued to be obsessed with people accepting that one man could have faked any of these footprints, let alone all of them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he had a reward, a longstanding reward out for anybody who could prove that they could make, you know, footprints that would fool an expert or be anywhere near a real footprint.
Through developing the documentary Legend Meets Science, I mean, obviously, one of the most notable things about that is that's the kind of first introduction that we got to Dr. Meldrum as well. It was kind of what broke him out and sort of elevated him to the echelons of cryptozoological research, Doug. So when you were sort of building your team, when you were looking at that, was it difficult to kind of sift the wheat from the chaff in regards to the quality of people you wanted to be involved in that? Because obviously, it, you know, this was the 10 or so years after your experience, so I would imagine you'd probably investigated and looked into all kinds of stories and come across many of the notable characters in the world of Bigfoot.
Yeah, well, one of the big challenges, it was only an hour, which means with commercials, you're looking at 50 minutes, a little under 50 minutes. So that's, you know, it's harder to make a short show than a long one. So, yeah, not only did it take forever to sift through everything, it actually was a little harder to get people to come on camera. You know, it wasn't that easy. But I picked things and, you know, cases like we did the Memorial Day footage.
Yep.
I picked that case because there was footage. There was an open mountain unobstructed with trees. There was a creature that ran across the mountain. And I thought, well, we can easily, you know, do a survey of the entire mountain, stake out the path of the creature. We can then gauge how quick it ran. You know, we used LIDAR radar even back then to map that entire mountain. And so everything we did in there had a pretty strict criteria. And thank God, because it's still, you know, all this time later, it still kind of holds, you know, it's still valid.
Yeah.
Everything in it's still very valid.
Well, I think it is as well. And I think that's one of the things about your work as well. And obviously, as you moved into Monster Quest. What always impressed me, Doug, about your body of work in regards to cryptozoological topics is there's very little woo. It's science, it's evidence, it's tracking, it's cameras, it's DNA. It's not just taking things on face value, whereas I think some subjects, people are very happy to just accept anything. Whereas for yourself, there's always been a real pushing of the boundaries. What, you know, regardless, because I know you were developing special cameras. I mean, obviously the work you did in regards to filming the squid, for example. I mean, that's remarkable footage.
Yeah. Bottom line is, I think we're going to find out one simple little stupid thing of what it takes to get footage of a Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a, you know, kind of one of those Homer Simpson moments where we go, duh, you know, it's like,
yeah,
that was so easy, you know, and then maybe we can repeat it again.
Mm.
At some point, somebody's going to figure this out.
Hmm.
You know, and I'm certainly trying. I could care less whether it's me or somebody else. What is the formula for fooling one of these creatures like the squid? Because the formula there was simple to me. As a fisherman, I'm also a fisherman.
Yeah.
I realized if you're going to send a robot down into the depths, 1,000 feet down, you're just going to scare off any animal.
Hmm.
And so they had tried and tried and tried. The Smithsonian had tried everything. And they failed at everything. And here I am just thinking, well, let's just catch a squid as bait. And let's put a camera on the squid. And then we'll send him down. And if my idea is correct, that the big ones never come up. They stay deep. They never, ever come up. And the little ones migrate up and down the water column. They get the food, they get the nutrients, and they come down. And then when the big squid eat them, they're getting the same nutrients.
Yes.
And it's just a simple, you know, very, very simple concept. Nothing, I don't think anything even creative. I look back at that, and it was just obvious to me what to do. And we got lucky, and it worked. And we got footage of the world's first Architeuthis ducks,
yeah,
which is a giant squid in its natural environment. And it's been confirmed now. There's a new 2-hour show in the history vault. I think anybody can. I'm not sure everybody in Europe can go to.
Mm.
But certainly in the U.S. you can go to the history vault, sign up, and then watch this new 2-hour show about the confirmation of the big squid that that my team filmed.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing as well, Doug, because, as you say there, do you think that's because you've got an interest in nature and you are a fisherman, and therefore fishermen are known for using strange things as bait?
Sure.
You know, I know a couple who use very odd things that, you know, if you ask the normal person, they just think about using maggots and lures. They wouldn't consider the possibilities of, well, squids are cannibalistic.
Yeah.
I mean, were you surprised that with all these scientists and biologists involved, that nobody had thought, well, let's give it something to eat?
Yeah, it's kind of a, you know, you smack your own forehead and you go, what the heck? How, you know, and I feel like, well, certainly you feel pride, but then you think, that scares me.
Mm.
If these are our best minds out there and they don't seem to ever think out of the box, that's kind of scary about science. It's a sad state of science.
Yeah.
At some levels. I really feel like I've gotten a number of scientists involved now for Legend Means Science 2 and got them excited to try to get a baseline on DNA, for instance.
Yeah.
But it scares me that they didn't do this on their own. That's what scares me. Why did it take somebody like me to get the ball rolling, to get a hold of the right guy who knows the right people, to them get them excited? You know, it's kind of scary. There's a gentleman I'm working with who is basically an academic coordinator and researcher. He has been, his name's Darby Orcutt, and he has been basically a liaison for finding some of the scientists that we're going to use, some really amazing people.
Yeah.
And they're he's gotten their curiosity up, and I'm going to supply the samples. And we're going to end up, I'm hoping, I really am hoping, because the technology is here today. It really wasn't a few years ago, to get a baseline of DNA on the Sasquatch. Because it keeps coming back human. Human or chimp-like. You know, the two things I trust are the human ones and the ones with some chimp DNA.
Yeah.
And there's been another one, Expedition Bigfoot, on some environmental DNA that they collected also showed chimp DNA. And I think it was Kentucky. And we did the same thing in Ontario. What is a chimp DNA doing up in Ontario? And we're not talking a whole bunch of genomes. We're just talking a few, you know. Yeah. But we're hoping to run darn near the entire genome. We're hoping to not ignore the data that doesn't match. That's the data we're going to go after. We're hoping to set a baseline because we have enough samples to submit. We have hundreds and hundreds of them. So they can retest and retest and retest.
Yeah.
And from different locations.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I'm rambling, but I'm really excited about the scientific breakthroughs that may, you know, end up happening with Legend Meets Science too.
Yeah. Do you think that's based on the grounding that you learnt so much doing the first documentary? And obviously I've spoken to several people in the Bigfoot field who you are or you have involved in this production. Doug as well. You know, I've spoken to some Shane Corson, for example.
Yes.
And David Ellis over in the Olympic Project.
Yep, yep.
Shelley Covington Montana. Yes. Is another one who's done some amazing work in regards to her fabulous DNA kits, and is such an interesting woman that I could have spoken to her all evening because of the work she's doing. And that,
oh, they're the real deal. Like Shelley's the real deal.
Yeah,
I mean they're not just out having fun.
Yeah,
they're actually trying to bring evidence forth and capture new evidence.
Yeah, I mean when I spoke to Shane and David. It was one of those conversations, like I say, Doug, I've had a real interest in the subject for a very long time. And it was amazing that when I had that discussion with Shane, I realised about some of the things I'd never even considered at all. Some of the work that they've been doing in regards to nesting and things like that, Doug. Yep. That I just considered it, well, it might be some kind of nest. I didn't think, well, do they use these over a certain amount of time? What happens when somebody goes in and messes this nest up? It was all these questions that... Once again, as you said earlier on, it's staring us in the face, but we're just not thinking outside the box. We're just looking at what we've got. We're not thinking, why is this here? Not what is it, but why is it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Why is it there? Why are there nests that resemble gorilla nests in the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah.
We don't have gorillas in the Pacific Northwest. Why are they weaving a very specific branch?
Yeah.
You have to have hands to weave branches.
Mm.
And yet, it still doesn't convince scientists. But we're hoping we're gonna be roughly dealing with 20 brand new giant chunks of evidence that we're going to be presenting to the world in a way that I think will get people's light bulbs to go off. Mm. Like when we investigate sound, we're going to show the world that a Bigfoot sound is extremely different than a human, and that no human voice actor can get rid of some of these lower tonal qualities that are completely missing mathematically. They're mathematically gone. I mean, this is just simple addition that you can see with a Hertz start and end that they're missing in these Bigfoot vocalizations that are authentic. And they cannot be duplicated by a human. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're rich, little, or some voice impersonator. That can't be done.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to take a body of evidence like that, and we're going to go so deep into it, but do it in a way that really gets your light bulb to go off.
Is it something that you've come across? Because obviously when I've spoken to a lot of other people in regards to the investigation of Sasquatch, Doug, there is always this reticence when it comes to mainstream science about people being involved in it. And I think if you asked most people who have an interest in Bigfoot, they could probably name on one hand the number of accredited scientists who have been brave enough to come forward and say, yeah, I'm really interested in this.
Yeah.
And when I've spoken to people like Amy and Shelley and Shane and the like, they will often tell me that they have scientists who will come and work with them, who do work with them, who have a real interest in this, who do not want to come forward.
Yep.
From when you did Legend Meets Science back in 2004 to where we are now, and all the work you've done in between, have you noticed anything changing in that kind of academic stance in regards to this subject, Doug? Or is it one of those where people just put you at an arm's length and go, no chance, I'm not getting involved in this?
Well, not really. I think people are warming up in vast numbers. The work Amy has done, and once again, just being a coordinator of getting these scientists to talk to each other who have an interest in it, you know, from all different study areas, from biology to marine biology, you know, all sorts of different disciplines, to be able to talk on a regular basis, which we're doing, you know, called ZooBook. But I think after Legend Meets Science 2 comes out, I think more will stick their head up and say, hey, I'm coming forward. I'm going to apply for a grant. I was talking to Carlos Jimenez, who you really should get on your show, Paul, who is an anthropologist who's recently just come forward, and he's going to be working on Legend Meets Science 2. He actually studied under Grover Krantz. He was Grover Krantz's assistant.
Yeah.
But still not willing to come forward. You know, he's a mainstream academic, but he's totally on board. And he's got a kind of unique taste and a unique way of explaining the problems with science, what's probably going to end up happening. And it's people like Amy and now Carlos and other people I'm dealing with, and Darby Orcutt, who are really brave souls and still pioneers in getting more people convinced to, you know, just get involved. But there's a lot of closeted scientists that are doing this and not telling anybody. You know, they're probably up at night looking at every, you know, everything they can get their hands on, but they're just not telling anybody. And that's sad. It really is.
Well, I think that just says more about the situation in regards to funding than anything, Doug, that these people seem to be so reliant on sticking inside the box and not daring to look out, that if anything, it's quite repressive. And I would imagine we shouldn't be in a situation in this day and age where we have academics who could really add something to this situation too scared to come forward.
Yeah, well, they're controlled by the corporations and by the donors, and, you know, the grant system really is faulty in my book. And I think we've lost hundreds of years of progress, just because if you think about how exponential science is, and let's say this system of grants and money that controls science nowadays has just had an effect in the last 40 years.
Mm.
Oh, I think it's put us back hundreds of years in breakthroughs.
Yeah.
And I do hope it somehow changes and that scientists just start realizing, you know, I'll starve, but I'm going to get an answer to this.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that it's what it may take. And often science breakthroughs in a variety of fields, Doug, are usually by that one person who's just swimming against the tide.
Yeah. Well, thank God that we've had the very few that we did have, like Jeff, you know, that was, you know, Grover Krantz, people like that. They certainly were trail cutters.
Yeah. And it is very interesting that when you're talking about these people and John Bindingangle and others, that, you know, we're talking about the best part of 50 years. And, you know, like you say, we probably mentioned three or four people. And for me, that's quite sad, because it's one of those things, there's a lot of parallels with sort of paranormal research, Doug, that it seems to now be developing into a more science-based study of that phenomenon, because I think people are beginning to think, well, millions of people are having these experiences. Something must be going on, even if it's some kind of brainwave activity or some kind of quantum physical kind of situation. Yep. And when we're talking about this kind of situation when it comes to the Sasquatch, the thing about this is, and I'm sure many people have said this, all it takes is one sighting to be provable. All it takes is one piece of DNA evidence to be proved that it's real. And that's it. The whole thing changes immediately, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, first off, I want to say that I don't even believe in the paranormal.
Mm.
I believe in super abilities.
Yep.
I believe in more of a supernatural, meaning everything's natural.
Mm.
Everything you see, if you see a ghost, I believe that there's just a physical reason for that sighting, that it's natural. It's not, it's just part of our crazy world we live in that's so complex.
Mm.
I think science and like the paranormal researchers really clash, and they shouldn't.
Yeah.
I don't see why they need to clash. Because, you know, when someone has a sighting, I don't care what it is, whether it's a UFO or some weird creature floating in the air, I think there's just, you know, a very grounded explanation for it. Not to debunk it, but to say it's really there. I've seen some things in my life that I can't explain.
Yeah.
But yet if I think about everything I've seen, I'm thinking, yeah, it's just probably an area of science we don't understand yet.
Mm.
If you went back 300 years and showed somebody your cell phone.
Yes.
That would be paranormal, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. It'd be some kind of magic. They'd think you were a wizard, Doug.
But it's just scientific development of equipment.
Yeah.
And so I don't really believe in the paranormal. I believe everything is just scientific development.
Mm.
It's dimensions we don't understand. It's.
Yeah.
You know, space and the things that go on. For instance, do we really understand all the time the sun, whatever it does, the effects it has on us, our behaviors, our weather, our, you know, God knows.
Yeah.
There could be a million things going on out in space that have huge effects here on Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, I don't know. I just think everything's natural, I guess. That makes any sense. An electric eel.
Yes.
Seems kind of crazy, you know, it can give you 100,000-volt shock, but yet it's just totally natural.
And there are tribes that can handle them. This is the other...
Oh, yeah.
The other remarkable thing about things like that, Doug, is, an electric eel is incredible, and it can kill you. And yet, in certain areas of South America, there are tribes that will just fish them out with their hands, which it is just amazing to me that, once again, that shouldn't be... occurring, and yet we can see it happen. We know it happens. So when you know things like that occur, it just frustrates me sometimes that a lot of people seem to just close barriers about things and say, well, that can't happen, that's impossible. But if you look at something like that, well, that's impossible, but it happens.
I've just experienced and seen so many things in the forest that don't necessarily make sense. Because we just don't understand them. I can think back of just things that you could almost dub paranormal, but they're probably just not. They're just normal, everyday things that we don't understand, and so we just classify everything as woo or odd. But why does that have to be woo?
Yeah, very true, very true.
We don't have any idea. We don't have any idea the abilities of a Bigfoot.
Mm.
They all very, very well might just be, you know, physical even. Things they can do physically. Things we've lost. Vision that they may have that we just don't understand yet.
Mm.
You know, I've suspected, for instance, that certain mammals, this has been going on for me for years, even before, like, they proved caribou can see in UV.
Yeah.
I already suspected they could.
Yeah.
That bears can see UV. I've seen too many things that... they'll eat this plant, and there's one that looks just identical to it right next to it, but they'll walk way over there to get another one.
Hmm.
Well, what in the heck is wrong with that one?
Yeah.
Well, it's because they can probably see the protein content.
Hmm.
And this one is going to digest and give them far more energy than this one.
Yeah.
And I believe Bigfoots can see in the UV spectrum, which is just basically a filter that they don't have. It doesn't take an advanced eye. It takes basically more of a primitive eye.
Mm.
To see in the UV spectrum.
Yeah.
And I think that could answer a lot of questions and camera traps and things. And I think the farther we go along, the more discoveries that we do have, the Bigfoot will be less and less of a mystery.
Well, I think it is. It's one of those things that we've got to keep pushing the boundaries, because I think, as you mentioned there, game cams, everybody who wants to poo-poo this subject, Doug will say, oh, well, we'd have caught one on a game cam by now. But the thing about that kind of attitude is that we presume that a game cam just sits on a tree and that's all it does. But they don't. They emit sound wave. They make a noise, even though we can't hear it. Yep. And if we're talking about a variety of creatures, because there are other creatures that know game cams are there and avoid them like the plague, don't they? So if certain other species that we know exist have this kind of relationship and ability to sense game cams or hear them even, why wouldn't something like a Sasquatch have a similar ability to be able to do such a thing?
Right. I've got a number of cameras that are not game cams right now live in the woods. It's a project that me and Adam Colt have done, and we're planning on adding more, throughout forest all over North America. But we're seeing and experiencing all sorts of bizarre things. For instance, we're seeing once in a while a glimpse of fur off from the back and knocking on the back of our cameras, like with a finger, as if to test them. But yet we still haven't gotten footage of what's doing it. If it was just a bird, I think we would have the footage of it because it wouldn't care. It would fly in front of the lens.
Yeah.
And even though these cameras are pretty well hidden, they're quite small. One may be way up in a tree and covered with moss.
Mm.
But we still have to have the lens showing. And it's like they've picked out every one of these cameras and are avoiding them. But yet they're letting us know they're there. Yeah. It's really interesting. We're having some very interesting sounds recorded and things that probably whatever's bugging our cameras has hands.
Yeah.
But we're not, we don't know yet, but we're just going to keep trying new things. And at some point we're going to get that footage we want. And it's going to be like, oh, that was simple.
Well, once again, it's probably one of those things that until it happens, we're just going to go, well, why didn't we think of that? And it'll just, as you say, smack ourselves on the forehead when it comes across.
Yeah.
I think one of the projects that you've been involved in that I was really surprised about when it happened was Les Stroud, Doug.
Yeah.
When he did his Survivor Man Bigfoot, because I was aware of Les, and obviously he's a phenomenal individual in regards to the situations he puts himself in around the world.
Yeah.
And when I saw Survivor Man Bigfoot, I have to say, on first glance, I thought, I kind of thought this would be quite a sceptical kind of project. And I was really blown away by the fact that Les, here's a guy that goes into the middle of nowhere to live on his wits and his abilities and his intelligence around the world, Doug. And he had something happen to him that's just made him question everything. Did Les reach out to you in regards to working on this project, or was this something that was kind of a next step for him? Because I think it was quite a surprising stance for him to take, to kind of, because he doesn't say, oh, well, I know this happened. He just says something strange went on. I can't explain it. I want answers.
Well, first off, I'll kind of tell you what went down, but the reason Les did his show is just because he's more honest.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
And he's probably more curious than most people, but it was the honesty.
Yeah.
So he had this experience and he was honest about it. He didn't brag about it. But I had seen an interview on, I think it was the Anthony and Opie, that he had did in studio interview. And I saw that interview. And I went, okay, I'm going to contact Les and tell him you should make a Bigfoot show or documentary because it will have a huge impact on society if you do. And I offered to help. And basically he wrote back right away and said, basically he'd been thinking along the same lines.
Yeah.
But certainly, I encouraged him. I just told him, I said, with your credibility, and the fact you were so honest and you're an open-minded, why don't you get out there and do a documentary, a TV series, whatever. So I don't know I don't have any idea what went on in his mind.
Yeah.
But certainly didn't help me encouraging him to do this. And then of course I was involved in making a bunch of different things to try.
Yeah.
And although, you know, when he's out filming, he doesn't have weeks to, you know, to play around with something. But everything I gave him was solid. You know, they were all new things that had never been done. You know, putting a camera inside a real grouse that was stuffed. So it wasn't a piece of, it wasn't like a plastic decoy. It was a really good taxidermy, you know, $500 stuffed grouse that we put a small micro cam in its chest and scented the grouse with grouse scent.
Mm.
And he was in a very active area, you know, that the natives had talked about, and he was in British Columbia. But that's an example of something that should be tried everywhere.
Yeah.
It shouldn't just be tried by less. So I was kind of hoping that other people would say, hey, I'm going to do that. I didn't hear about anybody trying to duplicate any of it.
Mm.
But that's what I was hoping, you know. You know, I know Les doesn't have the time. He's busy.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the time to go out and, you know, repeat that same experiment in 20 different locations over a year. Mm. You know, it's not going to happen because he's just busy.
Yes.
But I was hoping other people would. But I'm actually, we're doing that now. And we've had cameras up in the woods live for, God, since summer.
Mm.
Or since, yeah, early summer. And we haven't gotten any footage yet. We've got a lot of weird things. We've seen a lot of animals, and we've gotten some cool animal footage. And we've had some things that are certainly in our gray basket.
Yeah.
But we haven't gotten the definitive footage, but we're about to try new things again.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to change it up.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what really impressed me about Les's program was, and I think it's one of those shows that, especially outside of the US, Doug, I think a lot of people aren't aware of it, because I must admit, I stumbled across it by accident last year, and I just, it blew me away. I watched a whole lot in a week. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And as you say, even I think, was it eight or ten episodes around there? Even on that small run, the scope of where he went was massive. He didn't just kind of stay in one area, and obviously that's one of the other ramifications of this kind of subject, is you've got to go where nobody is. You know, there are risks involved in any of this regardless, and for Les to kind of put himself around North America in various locations, as always, you know, some of these stunning locations, but there are other aspects to this. So it's a monumental task, even basically working on the principle of one man in the woods with a camera, which is essentially what Les mostly does.
Yes. Yep.
And even at that level, Doug, as you say, you've still got all the planning, preparation and recon available to be able to deliver what on face value is one man in the woods. But it's a basic premise, but it's certainly not that at all, is it?
No, not at all. I would, you know, like, I would encourage Les to pick one location and stay there for a month and a half.
Yeah.
If he's got the money to do so.
Mm.
You know, we need to get somebody really knowledgeable like Les, or a biologist, to get funded so they can stay in one area for a long extended time, maybe the entire summer, in a real major hotspot area, to try to, one, get the creatures used, you know, basically a habituation situation, and trust and curiosity, and to see what comes out of that. That still has not been done. And that's, isn't that amazing, Paul?
Yeah.
That's not been done yet. It's been done with everything from penguins to polar bears, but not Bigfoot.
Yeah. Well, for people like us, Doug, it is baffling.
But I'm hoping that's going to change. I did get permission from a very famous biologist to do so if I could get him the funding.
Mm.
And that's exciting to me. Yeah. Really exciting. This is a major biologist that people would recognize his name.
Mm.
And somebody like that would, I think, do well if he could be funded and just literally take up roots in the middle of Vancouver Island, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, in an area where there's been numerous sightings.
Yeah.
And just stay there because, oh, the information they're going to get. Yeah. They're going to basically tune into the environment almost as good as a Bigfoot would.
Mm.
And notice the subtle things. They're no doubt going to have some pretty cool interactions, the very least.
When you kind of looked at doing a sequel to Legend Meets Science, Doug, I was very impressed by looking at the resumes of everybody that's involved in this so far. You've got the great and the good of modern Bigfoot research, and a lot of people with a lot of fresh ideas and new perspectives on this situation. And you're co-producing it with Justin from Mountain Beast Mysteries, who, for me, over the last sort of 5 years, has really done some fantastic work in his own documentary making for a guy that's very humble and quite reticent about his own talents. He's a very sharp-eyed filmmaker for me, and he goes to some incredible locations. So was that a relationship that you'd built up over the last 5 years, or were you aware of his work anyway?
No, I was totally aware of his work. I was aware of his attitude, his demeanor, his skepticism, obviously his filmmaking. You know, he's not afraid to hike 20 miles into an area.
No, he's not.
And stay there for a long period of time.
Yeah.
But there's more to Justin than that. Justin also, you know, we've basically got into filmmaking in completely different worlds.
Yeah.
I've always been supported by a network. He's always been supported by himself.
Yeah.
And he's done amazing. So I thought if we team up, because we're very different from each other, that we can output an amazing product that's also visual, beautiful, and extremely scientific and hard-hitting. Yeah. Thought it would give me some balance.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I'm just really excited to talk to Justin. He just got back from Vancouver Island filming for Legend Meets Science. We're going to conference this week, this coming week here, I think on Tuesday. But, yeah, he's amazing.
Like I say, I caught Expedition Sasquatch, which was his first full-length film, and it was just so surprisingly well-made.
Yep.
And like you say, it's very, very down to earth. It's very grounded. There's no kind of outlandish claims. Justin's one of those people that he doesn't take things on face value. And like you say, his ability to hike into the middle of nowhere is astounding, because he just goes to places that, even on a visual level, Doug, where he goes, it's just jaw-droppingly beautiful.
Yeah. No. He. I think we're both going to learn. Working together, from each other. There's a lot. I mean, I really have this dream of maybe this even being the last thing that I do for TV. But I want it to be the best Sasquatch film ever done. I want it to just blow away everything else. Not from an ego standpoint, but a standpoint of getting the information out and making people's light bulbs go off, making scientists go, oh my God, is that, that's a, you know, that is, there's no way. And hit them with 20 different new categories. I mean, there's new categories I don't even want to talk about yet. One that we have been talking about is the Alba Vernix.
Yes.
Or the skin oil. Because that's an example, one example of 20 of 3D evidence. You have latent details, right? Fingerprinting.
Yep.
You've got in the latent details, you've got microscopic details like sweat pores, heel scars. You can't fake this. In the skin oil, which is much thicker than human, you're going to have chemical compounds that are going to be very, very unique. For instance, we have, and the actual scientific name for these skin oils is surface skin lipids, SS. But we call Bigfoot skin oil Sasquatch Alba Vernix, which was coined by Shelley Covington, Montana.
Yep.
I had called her up because she had gotten a huge, an amazing face print. Her and Michael Waldy.
Yes.
On a case that they had investigated. And so here's this waxy, whitish, thick skin sebum on a window. So not only is there a, I mean, it's the entire face. And, of course, we wanted to do it right. But since she collected that and Michael was involved in this, I said, Shelley, why don't you name, you know, give us a scientific moniker. And she came up with this Alba, which means white, and Vernix, which is the waxy coating that babies are born with.
Yeah.
which keeps them very protected. And I do think the compound is very like that.
Yeah.
But they seem to touch at certain times, like, you know, windows, camper windows, house windows. I don't know if it's out of curiosity because they don't have shiny, glossy things in the forest to touch. Mm. And they're just, they can't resist.
Yeah.
But for years, I was looking at, you know, what everybody called muddy, dusty fingerprints. I'd seen them myself as soon as 2 years ago on a truck that we were on an expedition. And they were all over the door in the window. And I just thought it was dust. Well, I'm not going to get DNA from dust. So we didn't collect them. I don't even think we photographed them because I've seen so many photographs of them.
Yeah.
And here it was, all of a sudden one day it hit me. That's not dust.
Yeah.
That's actually a residue they're leaving. And if we can analyze it, we can find things like humans have triglycerides. Gorillas don't.
Yeah.
Humans have squalene, which protects them from the UV, yeah, which is one of the purposes of that chemical compound. Great apes that are covered in hair don't have any.
Yeah.
Because they don't need UV protection because they're covered in hair.
Yeah.
So if we can find samples every year, scientists, and repeat this over and over and over, and get the chemical compound of these samples that you can get with a Q-tip, as simple as getting it with a Q-tip and another one for DNA analysis, we now have the chemical compound. We can get skin cells that are going to be in that. There may be more nuclear DNA in the sebum than we're ever going to get, and by chance, from blood.
Mm.
So you've got latent, you've got DNA, and you've got chemical differences.
Yeah.
So it's 3D evidence. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And no one had ever thought of it. And so all I did was connect the dots.
Hmm.
Just went, something's wrong here. Just finally hit me. And then people started flooding me with photos.
Yeah.
Of this white waxy substance.
Hmm.
And so that's one of the things that will be in Legend Meat Science too.
I think what's very interesting, that obviously I've heard you speak about this, and obviously I've spoken to Shelley as well, about this fascinating facet of the evidence, Doug. And it's very interesting because it's one of those things that when you mention it, you then think, well, this makes sense, because if we're talking about a creature that's living in the woods, then surely there has to be some kind of protection for their,
yes,
for their hair, for their skin, wherever, because they're in the environment, you know, we're not aware if they use caves or tunnels or anything like that. We're just not sure what their kind of protection situation is in regards to how they hunker down at night, or, you know, as we were mentioning about nests and things like that, why these are being used. And yet, when you don't mention something like, as soon as somebody mentions it, it's blindingly obvious that there has to be some kind of secretion.
It's that Dah moment. It's, yeah, the Homer Simpson moment.
Yes. Yeah.
And you bring up an excellent point that I forgot to bring up. Yeah. What does this stuff do? It's going to protect them from wood ticks, mosquitoes, poisonous plants like poison ivy, itchweed.
Mm.
It's going to keep their skin soft and supple from drying out. It's going to keep mites away, mange. There's going to be a million. It's going to keep them waterproofed. It just makes so much sense. You know, why they have this. And so are they putting it extra on their hands? Are they taking it from their hands and rubbing it, you know, all through their hair? Is it coming from the hair areas? Is it coming from their armpits?
Yeah.
Because I recently found out through Zoobook, meaning a zookeeper, that gorillas secrete this white waxy substance from under their armpits.
Mm.
Have you heard that before, Paul?
I haven't, no.
No, nobody has. A zookeeper, he probably has noticed this for years, but he's not thinking there's any scientific significance to it. But all of a sudden he connects the dots, and he says to me, we can't even get this crap off the windows.
Yeah.
It sticks. That's exactly what I've experienced with the Sasquatch olivernix.
Yeah.
You can't get it off. It's like it smears. It's sticky. It seems to even react with certain ABS styrenes and plastics.
Yeah.
Because it's got either acids in it or volatile organic compounds.
Mm.
Which is basically akin to things like tree sap. Kerosene, oils, gas, which, you know, everything has volatile organic compounds in it.
Yeah.
But to a lesser degree, but this seems to have so much in it. Or could it be that they're finding things like tea tree oil naturally in the forest and rubbing it on their body?
Yeah.
And it's something they do on a regular basis. So when they touch something, you know, it burned into a camera trap, for instance. The actual fingerprint, you could not get them off. You couldn't scrub them off. The fingerprints were like burned right into the camera trap.
Yeah.
And so that could be maybe something they came in contact with, or it could be coming from their body.
Yeah.
But you bring up that excellent point. It's just such a duh.
Yeah.
Like, why didn't we think of this earlier?
Yeah, but it's one of those things, Doug, because, you know, even if we talk about ourselves, I think people are very unaware of the secretions that come out of our hands and fingers and wherever. You know, our pH level is quite acidic. And it, if we're talking about things like this, once you sort of look into that subject, you then start to think, well, why can't their pH level be of a certain level, which is why these fingerprints are so abrasive, that they seem to be impossible to remove, as though that, you know, as you say, it's almost as if they're burned in. Clearly, there's something going on, and whether that's a secondary reaction to, you know, as you say, there are numerous animals in the world that eat things that they use as protection or as skin oil or whatever, you know. Across all the animal kingdom, there are numerous adaptions that people use with their diet, Doug, and maybe it's something as simple as that. It might, for all we know, it could be eating poison ivy to allow its secretion. We just don't know, do we?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. We don't know. For instance, not a lot of people think a lot of animals eat ferns. You know, we all have ferns. You have a lot of ferns in Britain.
Yeah.
Ferns need a certain amount of rainfall. Ferns grow in Bigfoot areas, both here and probably there. Maybe they're eating tons of ferns, and that's causing – they're very acidic.
Mm.
And maybe that's getting into their – you know, they're secreting. I'm sure we've all been around somebody who was drinking all night, and you can smell beer on them the next day, even if they shower, because it's excreting out of their pores.
Yeah.
So what goes in comes out.
Yeah.
And, there's just – oh, my God. I have never been this excited about – finding out what in the world is in their sebum, the SSLs, and what we can learn from it.
Yeah.
We might even be able to figure out their diet.
Yeah.
Which would then help us find them.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, at a certain time of year, let's say it's some plant, it's full of their skin oil, is just full of tubers from some weird plant.
Yeah.
Oop, now we know where to start looking, you know.
Yeah.
Now we can hook up with GIS people.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think one of the other interesting aspects about all this is one of the key things about Sasquatch encounters, in a lot of them, Doug, is this mysterious aroma that people come across.
Oh, yeah. That's okay. I'm glad you brought that up.
And it's always interesting to me because it doesn't happen in some Bigfoot encounters. However, a lot of the notable ones, especially if it's a Class B sighting where people don't actually see something, but they hear it, they know it's there, they feel like they're being watched. Often they will say, everything was going fine, and then I was just hit by this aroma. Yep. And this is another interesting aspect of this, that often one of those things that I think people just forget. Wild animals smell, Doug. They all do. Sheep, horses, cats. If you've ever been out in the countryside or in woods, if you run across an animal in its natural environment, it will smell.
Yeah, including people.
Yes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is a real interesting mystery that's gone on forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I threw a name on it, basically calling it putrescine, because it does smell like a combination of rotting flesh, wet dog, manure, sulfur, even sometimes. And of course, the correlation with gorillas, George Schaller, one of the first people to habituate gorillas and be able to get close enough to study them, had noted smelling something that smelled like a combination of burnt rubber and sulfur from gorillas that they would release when agitated or trying to intimidate.
Mm.
So I don't think it's body odor, but I think it's something they're producing in a gland. It could be their from their armpit area.
Yeah.
I think it's called the apocrine glands. And back to the smell, I was going to mention one more thing. I want to get in because it's important. We were talking about the sebum. The zookeeper mentioned not only this white stuff coming out of their armpits, but actually bubbling.
Oh.
So anyhow, okay, back to the smell.
Yes.
I wanted people to know that. And so this is obviously great interest. So we collected a sample. We have one sample on a piece of basically plastic absorbs scent really well.
Mm.
On a piece of plastic, on a peanut butter jar, on just one that had this rotten flesh, and this jar was clean, like it went through a dishwasher.
Yeah.
It was found and collected. The guy that was collecting these jars, these clean jars out in the forest, he was on a search for the jars. And all of a sudden, he's walking around, and he's noticing, he's thinking he's got a Bigfoot trailing him because he gets blasted with this rotten flesh smell.
Yeah.
Rotten meat smell. And it was horrid. He's covering his mouth. He's walking around. All of a sudden, he realized it was one of the jars in the bag. So he called me immediately. We wrapped it up very carefully in a number of layers and put it in deep freeze.
Hmm.
That jar will be analyzed, and we may end up with the chemical compounds of what makes up that stink.
Yeah.
And whether it makes sense. And once again, we're going to learn all sorts of things from that smell.
Hmm.
But that smell, it was actually, Paul, my first experience with a Bigfoot was probably with that smell. I was hunting with my uncle and friends and cousins. And we had our deer stands, a quarter mile apart. It's still dark. I'm on my deer stand. I hear chest beating. I knew it wasn't a grouse. It sounded just like gorilla chest beating.
Mm.
And it's, maybe 4 a.m, still a little ways from sunrise. And all of a sudden I get blasted with this stink. I mean, I had to cover my face. I was gagging. And long story short, went back to camp at noon where we were all going to meet for lunch. Every single person, my cousins, my uncle, my friend, all had the exact same story. So whatever it was, went from deer stand to deer stand to give us all a message to, say, hey, this is my territory.
Yeah.
And I just, you put it in your basket and just sat there. But of course, later on in life, I learned that was, yeah, for sure. Probably a Bigfoot that created that stink.
It is remarkable when we look at things like that, and there are so many, it's like a giant jigsaw, Doug, that there are so many bits to this that I think it's going to need pulling them all together to allow us to look at the whole picture rather than just using vocalizations or casts or the fingerprint evidence. Everything has to come together because you've got to, we know the challenges that people are facing in regards to getting this accepted. And I think when you build such a body of evidence that you're covering every base from aroma to fingerprint to casting to filming to tracking, whatever, all evidence can only help support each other. And I think it's something that's long overdue because I think clearly people running around in the woods is great and fair play to them, but as I've said to other people when I've spoken about this, some of these people don't have any interest in science or nature or anything, so they're missing things, Doug. They might stumble across evidence and they're handling it, you know what I mean? And it's I think sometimes it's this lack of preparation for the evidence that I think's held some of it back for quite a while.
Well, for instance, there's a number of researchers, probably in the hundreds, that are having regular activity.
Mm.
They're going out, they're doing gifting, they're having, exchanges like that, but they're not collecting any evidence. They don't want to, they gave up on the camera traps. Okay, guys, take a piece of Velcro, stick it on your gifting area. And just adding that little piece of Velcro is now going to put you in the citizen science scientist category, because yeah. you're going to collect hairs on that Velcro, you know, the barbed part of the Velcro. Now, at least your visits, which probably happen once a week, once a day, are going to pay off. You're going to start collecting true evidence that we can analyze, hard evidence. So little strip of 10 cents of Velcro and you're in business. You know, put it on a blue object and leave it in your food area. You know, because I'm not going to stop you from doing what you do, but maybe add a piece of Velcro onto an object and see what happens. Yeah. Add some shipping tape upside down, the clear shipping tape. Very, very sticky. Stretch that on something. You know, leave your food items near the tape. Look at what's going to happen. You're going to find 6-inch arm hairs on that tape. Now you can take a sterilized tweezers, pull those hairs off and put them in an envelope. Now you've got something, you know, something that it may be the hair you collect that proves the existence of these creatures, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the key aspects of this, that I think when we talk about some of the people out there, you know, these are real citizen scientists like Shelley, like Amy, like the guys in the Olympic Project. You know, there are thinking outside of the box. That aren't just doing the same old things, Doug, because I think one of the other aspects of this is that, you know, some people have spent their entire lives on the hunt for creatures all over the world, be it Bigfoot, the Yeti is another specific addiction for many, Doug, out there. And for some, I suppose, the frustration of just how elusive it seems to be to pin these down, regardless of some of the footage that we've collected over the years. As you mentioned earlier, the Memorial Day footage is extremely famous, obviously Patterson, Gimlin, and then you've got others. You bring people like Paul Freeman's early work into it and other things like that. And it's, I suppose it can drive you mad.
It is maddening. it is, but, you know, never give up. Some things just, you know, good things take time.
Yeah.
And I don't want, you know, so many people have went, oh, camera traps don't work, so I'm not going to do that anymore. They're, you know, or they just jump to the conclusion that they disappear at will, for instance. And that may be true. I don't know. You know, there's no way I'm going to know. But why jump to those conclusions too quick? Why not still, let's say they do disappear. Well, that means they're still metaphysical then. They're here when they're here. Collect some evidence, you know, even if you believe that. It doesn't mean you can't collect evidence.
Yeah.
It is maddening, Paul. It is. For all of us.
Yeah, it is. And at the end of the day, you've got to use all the weapons at your disposal to try and conclusively prove this. And as you say, I find it frustrating when people just stop doing stuff because that it's not happened. And you think, well, all you have to look at is natural investigations for known animals, Doug. Some of them are some of the most elusive creatures in the world.
Yeah.
Animals are always turning up that we can't seem to find. And people are often surprised that a new deer turns up, like the one in Vietnam a few years ago, which people were just mystified how something that large could remain unknown. But it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's still going to be more mammal discoveries. There's no doubt. People think, oh, we've discovered all the mammals. No. There is about 1.8 million animals that we know about are living creatures on Earth that we've cataloged. There's estimated 10 million unknowns. 10 million unknowns yet. And so we've barely scratched the surface.
Yeah, you never know what's hiding in plain sight, Doug. I think that's the thing as well.
I mean, the other day we recorded, normal deer are red, you know, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, here comes this totally gray deer. The middle of summer walks by. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a different species of deer that we don't know about. I don't know if it's what they call a piebald deer. It didn't have any of the piebald characteristics. It was just gray. I mean, as gray, it's basically a silver deer.
Yeah.
It may be the first silver deer ever recorded. And, you know, this is in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And so those kind of things excite me. And there's just so many things that we don't know. You know, one of the things I was talking to a guy named Scott Deshane about, And he was reminding me that even our own atmosphere is a huge ecosystem, which goes from the ground to basically 300 miles out into space, which is an ecosystem.
Yeah.
We don't know what's living out there in life. We don't know if there's plasma creatures that feed on sunlight or they feed on, you know, Pseudomonas syringae bacteriums or algae. We know nothing. And it's a 300 mile deep ecosystem we know nothing about, as an example.
Yeah.
Are we going to discover creatures that are living in the atmosphere?
Yeah.
The whole nether world of science, there's not one scientist even studying that.
And it just shows you what the possibilities are endless, aren't they, Doug?
They're endless, and that's what gets me up in the morning and motivates me. And, you know, it's just sad life is so short, you know.
Yeah.
All one can ever hope for is that, you know, there's a way you can research after you're dead.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. I think about that. It's like, oh, gee, you know, I'm 62 years old and God, I don't have much time left, you know, where I've got my health and I can do stuff and, you know, and be able to contribute. But millions of jillions of mysteries, everybody who's listening, and get out there and try to solve some.
Absolutely. I think we all need to follow Peter Burns' diet, whatever Peter's done. Doug, to keep going exactly. At 95.
Exactly. And he's still going strong. Yeah, it's just some people are lucky or they're doing something that we don't know about.
Absolutely.
Yep, I love my bacon. I love my bacon.
Me and you both.
I guess every piece I eat knocks a half hour off my life.
Well, I think we're both in trouble there then, Doug. So, Doug, in regards to Legend Meets Science Part 2, what's the plan for this then? So, hopefully going to be launching a Kickstarter to look to get the funding together for a release next year, is that right?
That's correct, yes. You know, and most of the funding will just go towards science. Science, you know, basically to pay their expenses. We do have some universities that are going, we will help you, you got to cover our costs, which is nice. They still don't want to put it on the taxpayer dime, which I obviously don't blame them. But so we're going to need money, but how much exactly, I don't know. We're going to set a goal that's, you know, bare bones, and we hope people will donate a tiny bit, and we can actually come back with some solid things for them, and that they'll feel that their money went to a very worthwhile cause.
Absolutely. So have you got any idea when you're hoping to get that launched and up and running?
I'm hoping that by the end of the week.
Fantastic. So that should be running in September then.
Yeah, that's up to me. It's up to, in some ways, up to Justin. I'm going to blame Justin for any delays. So, Justin, it's all your fault.
Well, I'll keep my eye out for that, and we'll make sure I put the links in the show notes when the show comes out, Doug.
Yep, yep.
Anybody can keep up, and I'll make sure I put messages on there going down for further episodes, and hopefully I'll be able to fire a few pounds my way to try and push the boundaries on. Where can everybody keep up to date with you, Doug, and follow your work, my friend?
Well, we recently started a publishing company to help authors who are doing amazing research. Like we just got done publishing Andy McGrath's book, Beast of Britain, which covers cryptozoology in your neck of the woods. Uh-huh. He's about to finish a book called The Beast of the World, which will, you know, be a very enlightening book about cryptids all over the world. And so you can go to Hangar One Publishing. You can get a hold of me there. And that's Hangar with a one, numeral one. You can go to my Facebook page. You can go also to Untold Radio. It's untoldradioam.com. You can get a hold of me there and listen to our podcasts. And we'll kind of keep announcing new breakthroughs and progress on Legend Meets Science 2 on our radio show.
Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure links to that are in the show notes for anybody that wants to follow on, and I recommend everything you're involved in as something that people should keep their eyes on. Doug, it's been a real pleasure to finally speak to you. I just want to say thank you so much for the work you've done over the over the last 20, 30 years. I'm a massive fan of it, and I will always support anything you try and do, and I wish you the very best of luck with Legend Meets Science 2.
Oh, thank you, Paul. It was this was really, really super nice. You're amazing.